It's 9:06 and welcome to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher. My co-host today, Barbara Bretz. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi, Les.
So you have been busy. You bring friends in and you guys just have a lot of fun.
We do. We try to hit as many movies as we can. And I have to admit, it's been a little more difficult this year. I think some of the bigger premieres were pretty tough tickets to get. So we have been doing some waitlisting, but it's been a pretty solid year so far.
Yeah. So how's the waitlist worked for you, the new Eat waitlist?
Mixed reviews. Mm-hmm. I have been successful in getting a number, and some of my friends have as well, but we've been turned away several times. Hear a lot of discussions about people getting kicked off the system, that they press right away and they see that it's entirely open, they see the numbers going up and they're just unable to connect, or they get a systems error. So I think a lot of people have been frustrated with the system. But all in all, I think it accomplished what Sundance meant for it to do, which was to decrease the number of people congregating, I think, around the theaters. That definitely has decreased.
Mm-hmm. So have you been trying at like the Eccles and the Mark where there's more seats?
I have. Mm. And one thing I would like to comment on, and I hope Sundance considers it for next year, is, you know, after the wait list numbers are gone, they have you come back in order and line up, and 30 minutes before they cut that time off. So if you come with your number after that 30 minutes prior to the screening, you have to go to the end of the line. And my comment is, I wish that other people who didn't have a number could also just get at the end of the line, because I think a lot of people, if their number is higher, they tend to not show up. And I think of the 300 tickets or 200 tickets that they gave away, I think a large portion of people are not showing up for those counts. And I think it wouldn't hurt to allow it to be open-ended at the back of the line, so that even if you don't have a number, you could go ahead and get in line. And I think some of the venues are doing it, but they're not doing it at Eccles.
Oh, so it kind of here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Interesting. So, okay, well, you've had an opportunity to see some films. Let's talk about your favorite so far.
Well, you know, my favorite so far is Boyhood. That's the film that got a lot of buzz because it is Linklater's movie that took over 12 years to film and to do. That's really hard to imagine, and it was really incredible to see, and even more special to get the insight from the director and the cast members who were involved in that long process. And of course, Ethan Hawke was one of the stars, and he's no stranger to it because he's also partnered with Linklater in the trilogy of Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and After Midnight, which was also about, it, I think, more than a 10-year project in total. But the movie was really fascinating, and to think that they really built that whole movie around who was then a five-year-old child, Eller Coltrane, I think is his name. And it was just fascinating to see the kids grow up on film and to hear them all interact with each other. It was really great. So that's been my favorite by far.
Yeah. Did they talk about, I mean, what would have happened to the film had something happened to one of the characters?
You know, they didn't really address that. Ethan Hawke kind of took over the Q&A, which we thoroughly enjoy. And he asked the daughter, the girl who plays the sister in the movie, is actually Linklater's own daughter, Lorelai. And he said, "How old were you when this project began?" And she said, 8. And he said, "And how old were you when you wanted to quit?" And she said, "Well, about 4 years into it, I asked my dad if he couldn't just kill off my character." And he said, "That would be way too dramatic." But you could tell that they all just had really had a bonding experience, you know, throughout the whole process.
Yeah, so they came back, what, 10 days or something every year?
Not even. Oh. He said they would have 3 to 4 intense shooting days once a year. And so the film was done in 39 days of total shooting, which it just blows my mind to think of that. But it was very cool. It was really like getting a glimpse in somebody's real life, you know, the divorces, the graduations, the deaths, the whatever. And you just, it was just really fascinating. We loved it.
Okay. What else?
Well, you know, in that same long line, this is not one of my favorites, but I also saw a show called 52 Tuesdays, and I thought that was unique because it was filmed once a week on a Tuesday for a year, and that had to do with a transgender situation where a mother was changing into, a woman was changing into a man, and her daughter would visit her once a week throughout that year. So the fascinating process was really seeing the mother physically go through these changes. They showed passage of time in a much different way, than the Linkletter film in that every 52 segment, it would have the date, and then it would have a few seconds of news footage of whatever was going on in the world that day. And it happened to be a pretty busy year with Arab Spring and all of those different cultural events going on. So that was interesting, but not in my top 10 or anything. I think my next favorite film would have been Cold in July. And I was totally surprised by that because I am not a shoot 'em up, brains on the wall kind of moviegoer. And this movie had that, but the story was just so good. And the characters were great too. In fact, I made it a point to talk to the author. It was based on a book of the same title that came out in the 80s. So the movie was set in the 80s. And I went over and told him, I'm not a fan of the shoot 'em ups, but your story made the whole thing. So it was great. I highly recommend Cold in July.
Okay. Anything else you want to highlight before we bring in our first guest?
White Bird in a Blizzard was awesome. We saw The One I Love. Very entertaining. I like Mark Duplass and just about everything he does. So that was really good. Whiplash was awesome. And Fishing Without Nets really took me by surprise, too, because that's a foreign language film with English subtitles. And I don't think I've ever speed read the text so fast so that I could not miss out on any action. And it's a Somali pirate movie, but I haven't seen Captain Phillips, so I can't compare the two. But this was really outstanding. I highly recommend it.
Okay, we're going to bring in our first guest, so stay tuned. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open 7 days a week starting at noon for lunch, après-ski, dinner, drinks, and dancing. The website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
Great, thanks. I'm going to get your photo if I could just in front of that microphone.
Great.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host, Barbara Bretz. Well, filmmaker Sterling Harjo returns to the Sundance Film Festival for the fourth time, this with his first feature-length documentary. This may be the last time. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about This May Be the Last Time. It's part of the documentary premieres.
Yeah, it's my... So like you said, it's my first documentary. I have had... two fictional feature films that I brought here, and also a short film that I wrote and directed. I did a documentary. It's a documentary that I always wanted to do. It's about this very rare style of singing that the tribes that I come from do. They still do it today, and it's a style of singing that I never knew where it come from. Very distinctive. I knew that it was rare, and I just sort of started basically uncovering this story of the history of these songs. And
give us a little bit more background, though. I mean, you say you come from tribes. What?
I'm a Muscogee Creek and Seminole from Oklahoma. So originally my tribes were in the Southeast, and both of those tribes speak the same language, which is Muscogee. We were in Florida, Alabama, Georgia, until we were forcibly removed by the U.S. government to Oklahoma, which is kind of famously known as the Trail of Tears. These songs, we grew up with stories about how our people sang these songs along the Trail of Tears as like encouragement songs. And then you look at the history of it. I met a man named Hugh Foley, who's a professor at RSU, Rogers State University in Oklahoma. And he really uncovered this backstory to me that where Scottish missionaries came to the Southeast to, you know, basically spread Christianity. And what happened is there was this sort of commingling of cultures between the Scottish missionaries, black slaves, and Muscogee Creek and Seminole people. And out of that, this style of singing sort of, they all came together, and it sort of, the culture, it was sort of like, I guess like a cultural stew where this all just sort of mixed together. And out of that, all of these three groups sort of have this similar style of singing. The Muscogee Creek hymns, you know, they sound like slave spirituals. You can also hear the Scottish influence in them, but you can also hear the native traditional ceremonial song influence in them as well. So it's a very unique style of singing that no one knows about, basically. The story also interweaves with the story of my grandfather who went missing in 1962. He wrecked his car off of a bridge outside of the town of Sasakwa. And they found his car, but they couldn't find his body. So the whole Indian community came together and they searched for his body. And hearing this story over and over as a child, they always told me that they sang these songs as they searched for him. So, you know, it's really a story about songs and how these songs are used in the community and how they're used as encouragement, the history of them, but also the people that still try to keep them alive today.
Sterling, I wanted to ask you, the picture that you use for your poster and for the publicity is really haunting. Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's a photo of my grandfather. And, you know, in the film, you see the full photo, which is even more haunting, I think. It's this photo of him, and on the poster you can't see it, but you can't see his face. It's really just blacked out, and there's these really sort of haunting trees behind him. On the ground, which you don't see on the poster, there's a white dog jumping in the air, and he's just standing there, and it looks almost like Death of a Salesman shot or something. This guy in a suit and a hat and maybe a briefcase, and he's just standing there with this old truck and this old car and the woods behind him. And it was just my grandma kept these photos of him, and they were just amazing. It was almost like, you know, they were left because there was going to be a film made about him. I mean, you know, it was 1962. I can't imagine that a lot of people had many photos taken of them, mm-hmm. or at least as many as he had. And so I found, so all these photos I used throughout the film and to help really tell his story.
You seem pretty young. Did you know your grandfather?
I did not. I did not know my grandfather. I'm 34. So my dad was like 5 years old whenever this happened. So, but you know, something that my dad said to me, he said that he was really happy that I made this film because he felt like he got to know his father better, and, you know, which is obviously one of the highest compliments I could get, but it also feels the same for me where I feel like I got to know him a little better because, you know, I never knew him. I just know this event and this story, but telling the story like I did with this film, it becomes so real to where it's not just a story that I hear. You see how it affected people, and it affected people's lives, and it affected people's lives to this day. And part of the story illustrates the Trail of Tears and how we use these songs as well. And I think that's the same thing for that. You know, it's like this, you hear about the Trail of Tears, but if you stop and think about what really happened, it was a very devastating thing where people literally walked for hundreds of miles and, you know, thousands of people died and drowned in the Mississippi River on the way. So it's really a story of survival and how these songs were a part of that survival.
Yeah. So you were able to find people that still know the songs. Are we losing the songs?
Yeah, there's not as many people that sing them. You take it for granted though, when you grow up there. I grew up around them. So it was like, oh yeah, everyone sings like this. You know, it took me leaving and realizing how rare it was, first of all. And then you just realize that, oh, they're all mostly older people that know these songs. There has been an effort in the last, I would say, 10 years to teach kids these songs. And so there's a bit of a revival of them, I would say. But, you know, with the film and other things, I think that it'll help kind of influence
preserve
people.
It.
Yeah, preserve
Definitely.
It best, for sure.
So are they sung with words, or are they sung in the native language?
They're sung in the native language. It's a part of a lining out style of singing where back a long time ago, the Scottish missionaries, you know, sometimes it would be the priests or the whoever's running things that would, they were the ones that could read. And so they would just read a line of the Psalms, basically, and then the congregation would repeat that line in song back to them. That's the style that it comes out of. Now it's just you have a leader who starts off the song, and you'll hear them start the song off, and as soon as the congregation hears that first word, then they come in and they start singing with them. And it's a very mournful style of singing. It's in the Muscogee Creek language. And all of them are very much, you know, encouraging people to not give up and things like that. But they're very mournful. So it's, even though they're hopeful and beautiful songs, they're also, they carry sadness within them. And I think it's, you know, some of the songs were written on the Trail of Tears, and I think that that's why they are sad, you know.
So after this kind of investigation, did you ever come any closer to finding out what happened to him, your grandpa?
They never found out, you know, they ended up finding the body, but they never found out what happened exactly. You know, there's kind of a few mysterious things that I don't even go to in the film, just because there's sort of dead ends. There's no real way to know what was going on. They just know that he wrecked, you know, and there were rumors that he was being chased and things like that. But it's just one of those things that, you know, is kind of lost.
And so your reference to the title here, This May Be the Last Time, and what does that refer to?
So This May Be the Last Time, it's actually, there's a song that we have called Espogeris Omes Kithiskos, which translates to This May Be the Last Time, We Don't Know. And it was my grandma's favorite song. It's, you know, it's a lot of people's favorite song. It's it's a song that's basically used at funerals and things like that. You know, for me growing up, it always meant like, this may be the last time, you know, that you see your loved one, you know, you should be good to them. And so, but if you look at that song, it comes out of the 1800s, and it's just an example of a song to illustrate kind of how this cross-cultural exchange happened, because you have slave spiritual versions of this song. It was a slave spiritual song. It goes through, you know, gospel and blues adaptations. And then the Staple Singers have a hit with the song in 1961, maybe. I can't remember exactly the dates. In the 60s. They have a hit with it that is called This May Be the Last Time. And then Keith Richard from the Rolling Stones hears the song and adapts it into their famous song, The Last Time.
Wow. Well, Sterling Harjo is the director of This May Be the Last Time. You've got one more screening here in Park City at the Temple tomorrow night, 9 p.m. You'll also be at the Sundance Screening Room on Saturday. Best of luck to you. Fascinating story.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
For 35 years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, award-winning time-lapse filmmaker Louis Schwartzberg has captured nature that is too fast, too small, too slow, and too vast for the human eye. On January 31st, Park City Institute and Strategic News Service bring Louis and his work to the Black Box Theater. Tickets start at $25. The evening begins at 7:30. Call 655-3114 for further information. Brought to you by the not-for-profit Park City Institute, educating, illuminating, and entertaining since 1998.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher along with Barbara Bretz. Well, in 1988, Cesar Chavez, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union, embarked on what would be his last act of protest. The U.S. documentary film Cesar's Last Fast documents that. And in the studio to tell us more is the film's director, Richard Ray Perez. Good morning, Richard.
Hi, good morning, Leslie.
Well, certainly as somebody who grew up in Southern California, I knew who Cesar Chavez was. But really, until I watched your film, I had no idea of the man's tenacity nor impact. So why did you want to write the film?
Sure. I have a deep connection to the farm worker story and to Cesar Chavez's movement. My dad was a migrant farm worker for 22 years. Before I was born, he and his extended family, my aunts and uncles and my grandparents, came from Mexico and worked in the fields up and down California during the Depression. And my dad always told us these just horrible conditions they lived and worked under and how brutal and humiliating that existence was. And that story and those stories really were etched in my memory from childhood. They were my earliest memories of storytelling. And then I, when I was in preschool in Head Start in my hometown of San Fernando in California, this was like 1969, and there were college students who would come and volunteer at our Head Start. And one day, one of these college students sat down with me and my preschool classmates. And when we sat down to have lunch, and when he started eating his dessert, which was this fruit cocktail, I noticed he started plucking the grapes out of the fruit cocktail. And I was a very curious child, and I asked him, "Ooh, how come you're taking the grapes out of your fruit cocktail?" And he told me, well, because the people who own the grape fields, they treat the people who pick the grapes terribly. They pay them very little money. They make them live in shacks. They humiliate them. And if the grape pickers complain, they fire them. And I remember looking down at my grapes, and all of a sudden those grapes became very ugly, and I couldn't eat them. And I started plucking the grapes out of my fruit cocktail. And I looked up, and I noticed that all my classmates had been listening. And they looked down at their grapes, and they too plucked the grapes out of their fruit cocktail. So very early on in my life, I was sort of impacted already by that great boycott and the work of Cesar Chavez.
I know, it kind of makes you never want to eat another grape again.
That's a wonderful story. You know, I look at documentaries for all the different ways they educate us, and they all serve a purpose in some way. And this one, of course, definitely educated me to Cesar Chavez, your father, all the other activists that were so important. And it's a great tribute to them and always will be. But what do you hope it does from here besides that, besides pay tribute? Because obviously there's a lot of work yet to do.
I think there's a lot to learn in our documentary, primarily around community organizing and the power that people have to come together to confront a really big obstacle. In Cesar Chavez's case in time, it was the agribusiness. Now, that's still a problem. Farm workers in this country are still living in terrible conditions. They don't have the basic protections that workers have nationally. They weren't part of the New Deal protections that we take for granted. They don't get overtime. There are a series of benefits that don't affect them. But I think also what this film could teach us is that we can organize around any number of economic justice issues. Today, there are low-wage workers in the fast food industry, in packing houses in the Midwest, of course, farm workers, domestic workers. I think this film shows us that there's not only a model for community organizing, but it shows that we can be successful. It is, in essence, a roadmap for these new movements to follow and hopefully win the justice that they deserve.
Yeah, the biggest difference, though, when you talk about kind of those low-paying wages, you know, the meat packers, the fast food, the biggest difference, though, was that those people aren't working in toxic conditions. And I guess that's what I kind of walked away from the film the other night thinking, you know, after all has been said and done here, nothing has really changed with the farm workers, other than that we have banned maybe a few of the pesticides, but they're still really bad stuff out there.
Yeah, you're right, Leslie. The reason Cesar undertook this fast is because at the time in the late 80s and in all the 80s, pesticides were loosely regulated. They were sprayed on the fields and workers immediately went into the fields and started working. In many cases, they were sprayed while the workers were in the field, sprayed on the workers, and there were no protections. And you know, while Cesar Chavez helped raise the awareness around the effect of pesticides, and a few were banned, there were a total of five that Cesar Chavez and the UFW were trying to outlaw at the time. Three of them were banned, but new pesticides have emerged. And so it's an ongoing problem. You can ban a pesticide when the research shows that it's toxic, carcinogenic, or can lead to other health effects, but new pesticides are brought into the market. And the cumulative effect on, but not only on farm workers, but ourselves, the pesticides or the runoff from them are ending up in the water tables. And they have a detrimental effect whether you're a farm worker or not. And, of course, there's the moral issue. Should we be subjecting farm workers to toxins every day, looking the other way, and acting as if it's not a problem? But it still is a problem.
One of the comments from Caesar's son was so telling, that his father felt like he had never did enough for this. But I mean, he basically died for the cause. I mean, it was within 5 years he was dead. I mean, I think it really took a toll on him.
Yes, it did. And different family members have different opinions. But Caesar's parents both lived to be over 100 years old.
Wow.
But Cesar Chavez died at 66, so less than 5 years after he undertook that fast. He was 61 years old when he started. I'm convinced that it weakened his system. So he really did die for his cause.
Yeah. But again, back to the son's point, you know, that he didn't do enough. I mean, was that just his guilty Catholic upbringing? I mean,
yeah, and I don't know if guilt is the right term, but it's certainly a reflection of this intense dedication that he had that is unique. Certainly, all of us don't have it within us to sacrifice that much. But for him, he used his Catholic ritual, like fasting and other rituals, to dedicate himself to his work and to his movement. He was unique in that he was willing to dedicate himself and sacrifice that much. He saw it as a personal act of penance, that this was a sacrifice, that a practice to really focus himself and dedicate and work harder. Now, that's very unique. Few people can do that. But what we can do is when we see somebody fasting like that, we can ask ourselves, well, what's something that we can do? Certainly, we can't expect ourselves to fast for 36 days, but we can think twice when we go to the grocery store and decide what kind of grapes to buy or produce to buy, whether it's organic produce or not. We can start asking ourselves, well, where do our fruits and vegetables come from? Who picks them? You know, we can treat our low-wage workers, whether they're cleaning our houses or taking care of our elderly parents, with dignity. So it's really about asking ourselves, what can we do? What capacity do we have as individuals, and what small sacrifices we're willing to make?
It seemed like to me, though, timing, the fact that Jesse Jackson came in and came up with the idea of the rotating fast, that other people would share that burden or take it on. Had he or somebody else like him not suggested that at that particular time, it seems like maybe it would have gone beyond the tipping point and he really wouldn't have come out of it to even serve for 4 more years or 5 more years.
Yeah, on the 34th day of the fast, Jesse Jackson, who at the time had just ended a presidential campaign, came to see Caesar. And over the preceding days and weeks, many people had come to Caesar to try to talk him into breaking the fast. And Jesse Jackson was successful. And I think when you fast that long, many people believe you sort of lose your capacity for
reasoning
mm-hmm. and judgment. So that could very well have been a life-saving endeavor that that Jesse Jackson embarked on, to talk Caesar out of that fast and telling him, look, we'll take on the fast, us as individuals, 3 days at a time mm-hmm. in a serial fast. We'll keep the momentum of the act of fasting so that you can eat again. Mm-hmm. And really, Jesse may have saved his life.
And in addition to Jesse, there were a lot of other high-profile faces that I noticed either in the crowd or that you interviewed. Martin Sheen played a key role and was interviewed, but then I noticed Robert Blake and Mike Farrell and a few other actors
Kennedys.
That we know to the Kennedys, of mm-hmm. course, were there when he broke the fast. So were there other high-profile people involved, and do you think that helped the cause as well?
Yeah, that certainly helped, brought attention to the cause. And Caesar was aware. Well, Caesar didn't do this as a publicity stunt. Mm-hmm. I think people around him, in fact, when he started a fast and started that fast, it was 4 or 5 days before he told anybody. Mm-hmm. And so I think the people around him realized that they needed to rally support for him. They didn't want to turn it into a big publicity stunt, mm-hmm. but they asked people, how can you help bring attention to the pesticide issue? And so, yes, several high-profile celebrities at the time did sort of rally around Caesar. Edward James Olmos was on.
Yes,
and when it was time for when Caesar broke his fast on the 36th day, Ethel Kennedy and 3 of her children came to be at his side. You know, Robert Kennedy was with Caesar when Caesar broke his first fast in 1968. Joe Kennedy was at Caesar's side in 1972 when Caesar broke his second fast, and Ethel Kennedy was there with Caesar for his last fast.
That's pretty remarkable.
And says something about the relationship between the Kennedys and the Chavez family and Caesar specifically, but also the Kennedys' link and compassion to the cause and their relating and empathy with the farm worker movement and farm workers themselves.
Yeah. Real quick, just wanted to actually, I wanted you to explain something because I didn't really kind of get that. Maybe just because I don't understand that. But not only did Caesar have the growers working against him, also the Teamsters got involved and worked against him. Tell me, why was that happening there?
Sure. From the beginning, when Caesar started organizing farm workers, the Teamsters also had been interested in representing farm workers in the field. So there was a period where the UFW, the United Farm Workers Organization founded by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, were successful in gaining lots of many, many contracts from 1970 to 1973. When it came to renewing those contracts, there was nothing in the law that made the growers recognize either the union that their workers had voted for or renew their contracts. There was nothing. And so the growers decided, rather than renew contracts with the UFW, they decided to sign contracts with the Teamsters. So all of a sudden, the farm workers who were once one day members of the United Farm Workers found themselves members of the Teamsters without ever having voted to be members of the Teamsters. What happened was the Teamsters had negotiated a secret deal with the growers to take over those contracts. Nothing in the law prohibited that. And so essentially the Teamsters hijacked the farm worker members. What ensued was Caesar then asked the farm workers to go on strike, to walk out of the fields, to not be members of the Teamsters, and to not fall into this sort of betrayal, in essence. Mm-hmm. And that pit one union against the others, the UFW against the Teamsters, and it became violent.
Yeah. Well, again, Caesar's Last Fast. I think you've got also a couple more screenings tonight at 8:30 p.m. at The Mark, and then tomorrow at Redstone Cinema at 12:30. Also, you'll be playing in Salt Lake City at the Tower Theater on Saturday. Thanks so much for spending...
Leslie, there's one more community screening.
Yeah. While we were here, we had a local community member organize a screening at St. Mary's Church that will follow the 2 o'clock Mass. So immediately following the 2 o'clock Mass at St. Mary's Church, we're going to have a community screening that's free and open to the public. We want to encourage everyone from Park City and Salt Lake City to come and see it. It's a chance for us to share Caesar's story with the local community.
Great. Richard, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you, Barb.
Thank you.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
From San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. Leslie Thatcher and Barb Bretz here. And one of the films in this year's U.S. Dramatic category certainly has one of the most unusual names. In the studio with us is the director of Infinitely Polar Bear, Maya Forbes. Good morning, Maya.
Hello, good morning.
So can you just start with just the title? I mean, I don't get it. I haven't seen it, so I just don't even get this.
It's a hard ticket to get, Leslie. I've tried. So
I can tell you about the title. Well, the movie is about... is based on growing up with my father, who's manic depressive, and he took care of me and my sister for some time while my mother went away to get her business degree at Columbia Business School. And the title is when we were older, he managed to stay stable while he was taking care of us, and then when we were older and in college, and not living with him anymore. He had a hard time staying stable. And one year when we were both in college, he had a manic episode, and we took him to McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, to check him in. And he filled out his intake form, and it said, "What is your diagnosis?" He was filling it out and said, "Bipolar, schizophrenic, all these choices." And he checked other and wrote infinitely polar bear.
Hmm. Okay.
So that was his self-diagnosis.
So this is your directorial debut.
Yes.
You've got to be thrilled to be here, huh?
I am thrilled. I cannot believe it. It's been very exciting.
Well, and as Barb mentioned, I mean, we've been hearing some great things about it.
I really have. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you, since I didn't get to be there, is it has to be really kind of overwhelming to preview or to screen your film in the Eccles Center, which is a pretty huge venue for a typical screening. What was that like?
The Eccles, it was the first one, and it was just to look at it all, that sea of people, it was really overwhelming, and to have the response that we got.
A standing ovation, I understand.
Yes, we got a very long standing ovation. Actually, we got three standing ovations for at different times, which was so, super exciting. I feel like I was in a bit of a dream world. You know, it's hard to remember. It seems like a dream, but it was really beautiful and overwhelming.
Yes. So when you were writing the film, I mean, it came pretty easily to you?
No. I wrote this film for, I say 40 years, because it just is something that I lived, and then I processed, and then I wrote, and then I thought about some more, and then I tried to figure out how to make it not boring, entertaining, compress a longer period of time into a shorter period of time. I've been a screenwriter for about 20 years, and I this was the most personal. I wanted to write something very personal because I love 400 Blows, movies, Squid and the Whale, movies that are autobiographical and specific. And so there's only one way to do that, which is to write your personal story. I can't write someone else's personal story. So I worked on this for a long time.
Yeah, so you think it's more difficult to write your own story, knowing that you lived it?
Well, it's difficult if you're – it's difficult to turn it into a movie that you hope will be entertaining.
My boring
And capture all these different elements. I was trying to capture many different elements that families deal with, not just mental illness. My mother is black. I don't look black. My mother says I am unrecognizably black, which is, yes, how I feel. So I'm dealing with that as well, and I'm dealing with gender roles because it takes place in the 70s, and my mother was the breadwinner. My father, it was early for, you know, now it's more common, but it wasn't as common back then for the father to be the caretaker.
And he's from a quite wealthy family as well, isn't he?
Yes, my father was from two very wealthy New England families. But we were very poor, and there were a lot of New England – in our family anyway, there were very complicated rules about money, things I still don't understand, but you were not supposed to ask for it. The people who had the money were very capricious and would sometimes give you something when you weren't asking because they like to give you a little gift. But if you came and asked for it, you were always told, "We don't talk about money." Hmm. So it was interesting.
Well, one of my questions, I mean, before I, you know, 2 minutes ago was, it's like, well, how did you direct, you know, Mark Ruffalo? I mean, but you actually knew exactly what to look for in that character, huh? Given that it was, you were directing your dad almost, right?
I did. I was looking for a combination of humor and a heartbreaking understanding of pain, which Mark has. I was looking for someone very authentic and real because I wanted to do mental illness as I remembered it, which was as a real person. It wasn't sort of kooky. It was a part of my father that was sometimes delightful and sometimes the opposite. So I felt that Mark really understood the range, and that the biggest thing I was looking for was warmth. I really wanted to make a movie that felt very warm because it's about a family that really loves each other.
And he has that.
He's got it. He's got it, and he's great with kids. He has three children of his own. He was wonderful with the girls. And yes, he has warmth.
Maya, how old were you before you understood that it wasn't just your dad, that your dad had an issue? I mean, when did it all make sense to you, his behavior?
Well, I guess, I mean, the first breakdown that he had that I remember was when I was 6 years old. And it was a pretty extreme breakdown. It's sort of the one. It's the one that the in, that I use in the movie. The kids are a little bit older. It had the, everything had to be compressed because I didn't want to recast mm-hmm. children. You know, in reality, probably it's the whole thing unspooled over mm-hmm. 10 years. But in the movie, it has to
right.
3 years. You know, so I the biggest thing that my father did. I mean, I knew he was. There was no way around it. I knew that he was mentally ill from that time when I was six because we went and visited him in the hospital, which was one of the most painful experiences. Is just to see somebody who's so destroyed by the medication, which at that time they didn't understand as well. I'm certainly not anti medication for mental mm-hmm. illness, but it was at that. I think he felt quite like a guinea pig, mm-hmm. and he at times seemed very devastated by it. And so that was a complicated. That was the complicated relationship with the treatments that he was receiving, which didn't seem great. And then when I was about 13, my father said, "You don't have to not. You should." We were always hiding. My sister and I were always hiding the fact that he was manic depressive and embarrassed, and we wouldn't have people over to our house because it was a squalid pigsty. and then my father said, "You don't have. You can tell people. You should not tell people because mm-hmm. That's who I am. It's what I'm dealing with." And that was very freeing. Once we started telling our friends, they loved coming to our house. They loved coming over.
And in a way, do you see that as a function of your movie as well? I mean, to kind of
destigmatize.
Put it out there?
I do. That is my hope. I feel that many, many families deal with these issues. And they run through, it's genetic. It runs through families. And I think it's something that I don't think people should be ashamed of it.
Yeah. Is your dad still around, and did he have an opportunity to see him?
No, he died in 1998, my father did. So my mother was here for the premiere and loved it. And my sister, who wrote the song over the closing credits, she's a singer, songwriter in a band called Pink Martini, but she wrote sort of a folk song for the end of the movie.
So, and your daughter has a role.
And my daughter plays sort of me.
I was going to say, who did you cast? Your daughter. Perfect.
I cast my daughter. I mean, that's sort of the wonderful things about independent films. They're sort of family affairs because you just don't know when they're going to happen and you have to pull it all together quickly. And my daughter had done a table read with Mark Ruffalo and Zoe Saldana a few years before we shot, and she'd been great. And so I felt confident that she could do it. And it was great to work with her. The biggest thing is I know I could make her cry and I didn't have to feel guilty about it. I didn't have to go apologize to some other parent.
Well, again, Infinitely Polar Bear, you've got a couple more screenings as well in town today at 11:45 and again tomorrow at 2:30 at the Library Center. You'll also be in Salt Lake on Saturday. Any good news to report on anybody interested in the film?
We have lots of interest and we're still working on it.
That's great.
Well, best of luck to you. Thanks for coming by this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Maya.
It's Maya Forbes, the director of the film Infinitely Polar Bear. You're listening to the Sundance Reel.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Jan, I just don't know what to do.
Don, you're such a flake.
If only there were a show on Friday at 9 a.m. to fill me in on Frosty Weekend Fun.
I thought you knew. Warm up your weekend with Fun Friday.
Find out what to do, who to see, and where to go.
Don't be left out in the cold.
Tune in to Fun Friday for frostbite-free fun. Thanks to our jingly sponsors.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort.
Foothill Oriental Rugs.
Wasatch Pub, Squatter's Pub and Brewery.
And Summit County Business Directory.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. Just a quick clarification. We had mentioned earlier on Caesar's Last Fast, he had said after the 2 p.m. Mass, the screening at St. Mary's Church will be at 2 o'clock. So if you're interested in seeing that, that's when you need to show up, or probably a little bit earlier. Well, I guess I spoke too soon, because another film with a very strange title, this time in the U.S. dramatic category, Kimiko, the Treasure Hunter, in the studio with us, the directors of the film, David and Nathan Zellner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Did I get it right? Kumiko?
Kumiko, the Treasure Hunter.
Sure. Okay, Kumiko. So who's Kumiko?
Kumiko is a lonely Japanese woman from Tokyo who embarks on a quest to the Minnesota wilderness for a mythical fortune.
Okay. How does she find out about Minnesota?
She has a treasure map that she creates, and it's just she's unhappy with her life, and this is a escape for her for just a better future for herself.
All right. Now, are you two brothers?
Yes.
Correct.
All right. And did you have very distinctive roles in the film?
We have different strengths, but we, you know, between us, the directing, writing, producing, and editing, it all overlaps.
Yeah, a little bit of everything. So.
Well, you're also in the casting credits.
Yes.
So you're, what do you play, David?
A police officer that tries to help her along the way.
Yeah. And Nathan, what do you play?
I'm a tour guide that she stumbles upon as well. So she meets a lot of different characters when she gets to America that kind of try to assist her in different ways. And, you know, she always doesn't follow their advice or lead and kind of keeps going on her own quest.
So the story was based on an urban legend. How did you come across that urban legend?
In 2001, this story came out online, and it was, you know, this is before Twitter and Facebook and everything. So it was on message boards, I think. And it was just people, there was a little bit of information that came out just basically, you know, Japanese woman went to Minnesota. And it was so mysterious to us because the idea of going on a treasure hunt and going on this quest is such a, you know, kind of antiquated thing from, you know, like folk tales or from the age of exploration. And we just became obsessed with it. You know, from there, just kind of filled in the gaps with just trying to make sense of it in our own minds, what would lead, you know, someone on that journey. And so we, then, you know, ran with that urban legend and then added to it and created our story from that.
And you decided to stick with Japanese as the nationality. Did that present any challenges, or are you hoping that perhaps that's another additional market?
Oh, hopefully. I mean, it's very much an international film, I think. And because it, you know, just deals with, you know, this, you know, elements of the human condition with regarding like loneliness and this, you know, desire for putting yourself in a, you know, in a different place. We love Japan and that's where this, you know, the story originated from. So it seemed the best way to go. And we had a wonderful time filming there. Half of it's filmed there and half in America.
In Minnesota?
Yes.
Are you guys from Minnesota?
No. We're from Texas.
Oh, okay. All right. So you, so part of it is in Japanese, so with subtitles, is that what you did?
A little, yeah, in the beginning, yeah. And then, some Japanese and English, so.
Yeah, and then how does she make her way once she's here, though? I mean, does she speak some English?
Oh, yeah, she speaks English.
Okay.
Yes.
And she's pretty broken.
Yeah, she's bilingual, though, so, yeah. The causes some communication barriers to an extent between her and the people she's with. But, gets to America and then just, you know, perseveres to get what she needs to achieve her quest.
Have you been able to screen it with a Japanese audience at all?
Not with a large one yet. I mean, the premiere was, to individuals, yes, but, you know, the premiere was at Eccles this past Monday. And that was the first time we put it in front of a big audience, and it was really fantastic.
That's great.
So not knowing really the outcome of the urban legend, I mean, you guys just kind of wrote your own ending?
The ending we have is the only ending that mm-hmm. this story could have. So it just felt right. So
right.
Yeah.
Did you have co-writership?
Yes.
here. So you guys worked on it together then?
Yeah, we've been working on it for a while. The Urban Legend came out in
2001.
Late 2001, and we started working on it, as David said, as a means to kind of figure out on our own creatively what would have driven this woman to kind of trek into the snow by herself in search of a treasure.
Yeah. So what are you working on next? Do you guys always work together?
Yes.
Or no?
Yeah. Ah, okay. And we just finished this. So, I mean, we have several things we want to do next. It just depends on where the opportunities lie. So, but we just wrapped this up right before the fest. So.
Well, Sundance isn't the only festival that you guys have premiered. I noticed in notes Berlin and Buenos Aires. What are some big differences or similarities between the festivals?
Well, I don't know. They're all great festivals. Sundance has been so good to us over the years. This is our eighth time with a film here. We've had 3 features and 5 shorts. And, we owe everything to them for their continued support, for our work when no one else was paying attention to what we were doing. So that is meant so much. So we love it's an honor to be able to premiere anything here. And then next up, Berlin is great. Different. It's fun showing our films in different parts of the world, just the way people respond differently. Because a lot of our films, we try to ride the line between humor and pathos. And so just depending on the audience and the culture, it's a different, it could teeter one way or another. Mm-hmm. So it's always fun, sharing them with people in different places. Yeah. So
especially international audiences, because they have a very, you start realizing how they perceive, an American film and their idea of what an American film should or shouldn't be or could be. So it's, they always have a different interpretation. That's something that we didn't anticipate, but it's, it's always been positive, but it's just fun to kind of see their reactions are usually different than what we would, hear here in Park City.
Well, Park City people have a couple more opportunities to see it here in town again today, 2:30 at Prospector. Saturday at the Egyptian Theater, starting at 9 a.m. You'll be in Salt Lake City tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Any good news with the future of the film at this point?
The Berlin is where it will be showing next for its international premiere. And then, that's the latest update on the Kamiko front. So hopefully more and more places. We want to get it out there to as many people as possible.
Well, best of luck to you. Thanks for stopping by here this morning.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Speaking with Nathan and David Zeller, again, directors
Zellner.
Directors of Kumiko, the Treasure Hunter.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com, Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And with a quick wrap-up again, Barbara Brett's here in the studio with me. What's on your list of things must see before by Sunday?
Well, I've got a ticket to see Lambert and Stamp, which is the movie about, I think it's a documentary about
the
discovering of the Who. So that's high on my list. I'd love to get in to see Infinitely Polar Bear, but I don't know that that's possible. Song One possibly is on my list. Rudderless is on, and Wish I Was Here. The Zach Braff entry. Those are the only for sure ones. I'm going to be doing a couple more wait lists and looking for some of the award winners. And, of course, the Best of Fest. I always get tickets for that, which is a great opportunity for locals to see what's kind of risen to the top. And I think those premieres are on Monday at the Eccles.
Okay. And so you've sat through some Q&As that you wanted to highlight as well.
Oh, we love the Q&As. And I think that's just the real benefit of being here at Sundance. I mean, a lot of these films will make it into regular theaters, but to actually hear the directors talk about it and see the cast interact, it always just gives a lot more insight. And we were kind of reminiscing about the last 14 years of Sundance. And one of our favorite Q&As of all time was Robin Williams when he was in a Bobcat Goldthwait 8th movie called World's Greatest Dad. And it was basically a 30-minute stand-up comedy routine between the two of them. I think they probably went about 12 minutes over. They just couldn't be stopped. And so that we really got our money's worth on that ticket. That was great. And, of course, we love Mark Duplass. We did a wait list line for The One I Love the other day. And he and Elizabeth Moss are in that film. And he's just such a unique Sundance repeat actor and director, and we always love the Q&As with him as well.
Okay. Well, thanks for being with us today. Again, this is another wrap of the Sundance Reel. You're listening to KPCW Park City. And again, the Sundance Reel only in Park City, only on KPCW. It's 10 o'clock. Stay tuned now for news, followed by music.